Former Ohio Democratic Party Chair Jim Ruvolo, once a critic of Jerry Springer's earlier efforts to run statewide, now the party is waiting to see if either Springer or Richard Cordray will enter the race for Ohio governor. I'm Mark Haney. Also on today's show, we'll hear about the Inquirer's in-depth look at the impact of the local drug epidemic. First up, a study finds the Hamilton County Land Reutilization Corporation has not properly maintained a number of its properties. WCPO.com reporter Paula Christian has been covering this story, and she joins us now. And if you have any questions or comments, you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Good afternoon, Paula. Good to see you.
Oh, you too. Always a pleasure.
Now, this is commonly known as the land bank. It has that fancy official name to it, but it's also known as the land bank. What's the purpose of this organization?
Well, it was created by statute in Ohio in 2008, I believe. It's just a way to keep properties of last resort, properties that people can't maintain anymore, that may be in foreclosure or have tax delinquencies that people can't afford to keep. So instead of letting them just fester, this is a way for people to turn them over, and the land bank will take care of them and maintain them.
So who runs the land bank?
Well, in Hamilton County, it's being overseen by the Port Authority. So they are the ones who are tasked with picking up these blighted properties and storing them for future development.
And does it try to resell these homes at some point?
Sometimes. I mean, sometimes the homes are just, it's better off for them to be demolished and just have the vacant lots for future development. Maybe if you had a few together, you could have something like a new parking lot or for a new development coming in. Other times, it's just making sure that they're not sites for constant crime and squatters living there, make sure they're properly boarded up until they can be resold.
Are there any of these that are recognizable structures that listeners would know, that like big buildings of any type, or is it mainly just residential places?
The land bank, it's residential places. But there are, for example, in Evanston and Walnut Hills, which has been a big center of development for the land bank, there are many, many properties there, which are in beautiful condition that the land bank owns. Lots that are mowed, lots of rehabs, especially around Walnut Hills High School, really nice buildings.
So how many pieces of property does the land bank own?
Currently, they own 716 properties, which is a huge increase from just 5 years ago. It was less than 200. So big jump.
Yeah, and of these 700 and some odd properties, I mean, how many are blighted? How many of them are in good condition?
Well, when I decided to take a look at the issue, I drove out and took a look at 52 properties. And I looked at Madisonville, East Price Hill, Evanston, Walnut Hills. And I found of those 14, which works out to about 26%, were in pretty bad shape. So 14 of the 52. Now, they've done their own independent analysis, and they say about 6% of their properties are blighted with tall grass or weeds or dumping. I don't have any way to independently verify that. My percentage was much higher.
So this has to be really frustrating for somebody who lives next to a blighted property.
Oh, that was the saddest part of the whole story, is to talk to these neighbors who, first of all, they didn't even know that the land bank owned the property next door to them. The property that they've been mowing the grass, they've been pulling the weeds, they've been so frustrated and sad that their own property value is being affected by this house that's largely, or a lot that's completely being ignored. And they were very frustrated and very upset, because if a private property owner owned this lot, they would be fined.
Now, how many people are even aware of this organization? I mean, I'd heard the term before, but I wasn't fully sure of what it was or what it does. So I wonder how many people really know.
You know, before I did this story, I really didn't know. I didn't understand what the land bank was and what it did either. So I would say probably not that many people understand what it is. When I say that it's an organization that receives a lot of city and county funding and also makes its money from delinquent tax payments, then people, all they hear is, oh, it's a governmental arm. The government owns it. The city owns it. The county owns it. It's their fault. So,
but that means taxpayers are funding it, though, right?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of.
So how did this come to your attention?
Well, so Kevin Flynn, Councilman Kevin Flynn, he drove by this really terrible stretch of land on Coleraine Avenue that was waist-high weeds, and the sidewalks like virtually covered with weeds and vines. And he took a picture of it, and he sent it out to the media, and he said, the land bank owns this property and you need to fix it up. And then he filed a motion saying, until the Port Authority, which oversees the land bank, starts maintaining its properties, we're going to withhold $700,000 in city funding, which is a large amount of money, until you essentially do what you're supposed to be doing to begin with.
Okay, so it was a motion. Did it actually go through? Did that happen?
It has not been acted on by city council yet, because he filed it in late July and city council's been mostly off for the summer. So it has not been acted on yet.
But as far as you know, he's going to keep pushing for
this. Yes,
yes. Now, when you were looking into this, you found out that they were using, what, two contractors to maintain the property?
Yes. They have two landscaping contractors to maintain 716 properties. Now, a handful of those are maintained by community development corporations like Price Hill Will, but the vast majority, the land bank has to mow the grass. And these are properties, not just the city of Cincinnati, but Hamilton County, which is 413 square miles. That's a
big area for just two contractors to be handling. So I guess that's part of the problem with this.
Yes, it is a huge part of the problem. Is there's no physical way they can get to this many yards. I mean, the yards are supposed to be mowed every 10 to 14 days. I don't know if that's physically possible unless they work 24 hours a day to get to all of these yards. But these fundamental basic questions should have been, they're not, it's not rocket science to figure out the two contractors can't do this.
Yeah. You know, also, you have to ask the question too: Why is government owning this much property?
Well, you know what? That is a question that I posed to the land bank, because I said, if you can't take care of the property you already own, what's the argument that you should be acquiring more? And they said simply, you know what? We might have a few things we need to work on, but there is no other choice. We have a significant and serious problem with blighted properties in the city of Cincinnati. There are 2,200 known, vacant, uninhabitable, blighted properties just in the city of Cincinnati. And if the land bank doesn't take over more of them, there is no other option. I mean, they will just sit as they are and worsen being owned by absentee landlords.
So they're talking about expanding. They're thinking about growing this.
They would like several hundred more properties.
Okay, so from 700 to maybe 900 to 1,000 properties. Okay.
I think they would like as many as they can get. They have a big learning, not a big learning curve, a big growth curve. I mean, they've got to catch up on the maintenance of the property they already have. I mean, the photos of these houses.
It's not just high grass. It's a lot of big messes.
It is dumping. It is, I mean, in some of these backyards, the weeds are waist high. They've become complete dumping grounds for old furniture, mattresses, carpets. I mean, some of these houses, people are clearly living them in them or have been illegally. And it's the vines are up to the second floor, going in the windows, and some sides of the house are completely covered, and it's bad.
You know, with the lack of affordable housing, why not just turn a lot of this into affordable housing for people?
Well, I think it boils down to money, to be honest. I mean, you know what? I don't know if enough people know the housing stock that is available to purchase from the land bank for very little price. I mean, the prices are very small. I'm not sure people realize that they can buy these properties and they can rehab them. And perhaps that's part of the solution. But maybe they need to do a better job of marketing them.
Yeah. Now, the land bank has just come under new, has a new director, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Jessica Powell worked for the city of Cincinnati in the solicitor's office, and she's very well known as a real advocate for neighborhoods and housing. So Councilman Flynn was very excited to see her come on to the land bank. And I do think that Jessica will really make a big improvement to how the land bank is being run now. She was, unfortunately, she'd only been on the job 3 weeks when we asked to do an interview for this story. So, you know, she's not really responsible for the lack of maintenance over months and months and months. But she was, you know, sort of forced to answer the questions.
So what kinds of steps are they taking to correct this?
Well, for one, they're going to hire more than two landscaping contractors, which would be a big first step.
Get some extra help in
there. So when the contracts are up for rebid in December, they're going to open up the process to more contractors. They want better contractors, more contractors. They're going to hold them more accountable. They're going to show them photos of what's not acceptable, what they're not going to put up with. And they're also pairing up with Cuyahoga County's land bank on some software. So they will actually be able to key up any property they own with a current photo. And every time a landscaper services it, they can see the after photo. So if it's not done the way it's supposed to be done, then they will have to go back and do it again. And that's part of the problem is, as with all government, is that they were not watching closely enough. And this is what happens.
So where do you plan to go next with this? Or what might be a follow-up on this story?
Well, for one, I am going to go back next summer and look at land bank property again to see if there's been any improvement like has been promised. And then also, the land bank is not the only offender. There are other governmental agencies that also own property in the city of Cincinnati that have just as many high weed and litter violations. And I will be taking a look at that as well.
You know, meantime, Paula, what can someone do if they live next to a blighted property?
Well, please do something. Please say something. The easiest thing to do is look up on the Hamilton County Auditor's website. It is an excellent website, very easy to use. Plug in the address, see who owns it. If it's a governmental agency like the Land Bank, Cincinnati Metropolitan Housing Authority, you need to call them and complain. And you can also call the city's Department of Public Services. It's very easy to file a litter or high weed complaint. They will send someone out, and if there's a violation, it is a steep fine. So please do not do nothing.
Paula, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.
WCPO.com reporter Paula Christian. And there's a link to her land bank coverage at WVXU.org. Up next, Ohio Democrats are waiting to see who jumps into the governor's race next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The Ohio Democratic Party is waiting to see if either Richard Cordray, who currently runs the federal government's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or TV talk host Jerry Springer will enter the race for governor. And joining us with an update on the Ohio governor's race from Ohio Public Radio, Andy Chow and Joe Ingles, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Andy, Joe, and Howard, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
So, Andy, you actually attended the AFL-CIO Labor Picnic in Cincinnati this week, didn't you?
I did. I was able to drive down to the wonderful city of Cincinnati this week.
And both Richard Cordray, Jerry Springer were there. So let's start with Cordray.
Oh, nope. Well, I will say that Richard Cordray was at the Cincinnati AFL-CIO Labor Day picnic. Jerry Springer was up in Cleveland
Cleveland.
Very similar event.
Okay.
So Richard Cordray was there. There was a little bit of buzz before – well, a lot of buzz the days leading up to it about what he may or may not say regarding a possible run for governor. When he actually went up on stage, it was clear he was not going to make an announcement there and then. And because of his position as director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, he had to keep his comments very direct and limited to only his job with the CFPB. So he didn't make any big political speech. He didn't say anything too out of the realm of what he usually says. And he was there to talk about how he is there to protect consumers, how he's there to be the watchdog for consumers. And that was basically it. And I think the big thing politically for him was that he was able to meet and greet a lot of people off stage, not in front of the cameras, shake a lot of hands and do some politicking that way.
You know, I've been to a lot of those picnics over the years, Andy, and I never did think, I never believed that that would be the right venue for Rich Cordray to kick off a gubernatorial campaign. Because, number one, nobody's paying any attention to the speeches. They're having a picnic. Each labor union has its own little area where they cook out, they grill, they just have a good time. And it's not a very good place to do that kind of a thing. Although
so there's a lot of other stuff going on.
You know, as I understand, Andy, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, there weren't that many people around, standing around listening to that speech.
There were not. You're right. And it was a little bit of a surprise just because of the lead up, the events leading up to it, thinking that it was going to be a big deal. But you're right. I mean, there were thousands of people there, but they're there. They're taking their family, their kids to this picnic. I think the last thing that a lot of families want to do is hang out and listen to politicians speak.
They were over on the other side of Coney Island with their kids, going on the rides and in the swimming pool. But, I mean, it's just not a very good venue for that. And he made a speech, which, as you said, was, you know, pretty dry and very, you know, technical and talking about his job.
Rich Cordray could violate federal law if he talks about running for office while he's holding a federal job.
That's the point I'm making, that when he was a candidate for attorney general, when he was a candidate for state treasurer, he made great political speeches. I mean, real good barn burner speeches. But he's not in that position now. He can't do that. And anybody that expected him to do that at Monday's picnic was just, you know, dreaming.
Unless he was going to, you know, put out some tea leaves beforehand, drop some hints that he was going to resign.
Exactly.
And the days leading up to it, when it was clear that he wasn't leaking any sort of information regarding a resignation, we all kind of assumed he wasn't going to drop this big bomb on us there and then at the event.
That's exactly right.
Joe, what's your sense of where Richard Cordray is headed? Do you think he's going to resign and run for governor?
You know, that's really hard to tell. I mean, we've always heard that he might be interested. He has the resume, certainly, where he could, you know, come into the race and, come in late and still be able to achieve, you know, and win, possibly. But I think, honestly, it's going to depend a lot on what Jerry Springer does. Because I don't know if Jerry Springer does get into the race, and there is talk of that, and it looks like there are signs of that. If that were to happen, I just don't see both of them being in the race at the same time.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe they would, but I don't see that. Well, I think one of them's going to – it's one or the other.
Right, Joe. And I think, you know, if Springer did get in the race, it would kind of clear – not, it probably wouldn't clear the entire field, but it would clear out a good portion of the field. And I'm not sure that Cordray would be the one to take him on. But we'll see. And, you know, nobody's quite sure what Jerry's going to do at this point. But as you say, there are some signs that he might do this. There are other people who would like to see him run for Congress, say in the 2nd Congressional District against Brad Winstrup. He's being urged to do that as well. I mean, even some people talk to him about running for the 1st District against Steve Chabot, which I think would be a very big mistake. But, you know, he's getting a lot of pressure from all sides about running for governor, Congress, something. And there's no question in my mind, Jerry, over the years, has really wanted to someday get back into politics as a candidate.
You know, Howard, I have to wonder, though, Springer has been very successful in his TV career. Mm-hmm. Right. He's 73, I think, now.
And a gazillionaire, yeah.
Yeah. Why would he want to do this?
Well, that's a real good question, Mark. Why? I think because he does have some very deeply held beliefs. He is one of the best political speakers I have ever heard. When I hear him speak in a political context, like at the Democratic National Convention before the Ohio delegation last year, he gave a very moving speech. Very powerful speech. I've seen him do it before UC students. I've seen him do it at Democratic Party fundraisers, which he does very often, especially here in Southwest Ohio. So he's good at it. He's good at, I think he'd be good at the running part of it and the speech making part of it. Whether or not he'd be good at the governing part of it, I don't know.
You know, he considered running for Senate in 2000, 2004. Yes. And I think the thing that everybody would think then was he's the host of this tabloid, some people say trash talk show. There's no way that he's electable. And obviously, we've seen through a couple of different elections, of course, President Donald Trump being the biggest example, that somebody with a personality, somebody who is a celebrity, even if it's not, the most sophisticated TV programming of all time, somebody like that can win. And I think the other factor that goes into this, and if you listen to Jerry Springer's speech in Cleveland this week, he seems very personally troubled by what he's seeing in government lately. He's very personally troubled by the Trump administration and what's happening to labor groups in Ohio. And I think the drive that Howard's talked about of how he has this drive to be in government, and then recent events, I think that's what's steering the current that way.
You know, I think it's really interesting when you look at Jerry Springer. Everyone brings up this tabloid talk show, and I was the moderator for a debate at the Columbus Metropolitan Club a few months ago, at the end of last year, and Jerry Springer was on the panel, and I threw him questions about that talk show because, a lot of people don't like that talk show, including a lot of people who say they support him for governor. So I asked him some tough questions about it, and basically he was able to give well-thought-out answers to every question I threw, and even the people who came in and they were kind of, skeptical of him as a, because of the talk show and that sort of thing, they were leaving that event saying, he's smart. He's got something going on. So he was able to take a crowd that was not in his corner necessarily beforehand and at least make a good part of them somewhat open to his message. And I think that we need to keep that in mind, that he has that ability. We need to keep that in mind when we're talking about Jerry Springer and his chances to be governor. If he has the ability to make those switches and he's immediately starting to pull in some voters that haven't been tapped in recent elections by the Democrats, I don't think you can count him out by any means.
And Joe, Springer has said he wouldn't run for office if his show is still on the air, right?
Yeah, he has said that. And the timing is coming up. That's another thing here. He's going to have to make some decisions here soon as to whether he wants to continue to have that show or whether he wants to run for office. It would be very difficult for him to do both. He does have the show down there in Cincinnati I think it's over on the other side of the river.
Yeah, but he does it in Ludlow, I
believe. Podcast, yeah. Yeah.
He's got a podcast.
Yeah, the podcast. And that's definitely more in this wheelhouse. It's a lot of politics and talking that sort of thing. So he could definitely continue to do that, but it would be hard for him to do the TV show that he's been doing.
Yeah. I mean, every time Jerry comes to Cincinnati or anywhere near, this media market and does a political speech, he talks about the show and he says, the show's stupid. I know that. Mm-hmm. It's an idiotic show. But that's not all there is to me. And older voters in Cincinnati realize that there was a Jerry Springer before that talk show. And the fact is, that talk show is very popular probably with a whole lot of voters that the Ohio Democratic Party, as Joe indicated, have not been able to reach, and that Donald Trump did reach in 2016. People up and down the Ohio River from southeast Ohio up into the Mahoning Valley, those people may just be Jerry fans. And sitting there, you know, if he announces, they're chanting, Jerry, Jerry, Jerry.
So you think Jerry's celebrity. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, there is that, the celebrity part of it, but he's different. And like I said, he makes a great political speech. I mean, he's absolutely one of the best I've ever heard. And I've heard a bunch of them.
And I think a lot of people are looking at the slate of Democratic candidates who are running for governor right now, and not to take anything away from them, but none of them have brought up that kind of excitement. Nobody has as much name recognition as Jerry Springer does. And I really think that he could be a really big contender, not just in the primary, of course, but in the general election. If he jumped in this race, it would change the whole ballgame.
Yeah, that's a truth. I mean, you know, and take nothing away from the four people who are running right now, and tell you, and the fact is that based on their resumes, the four of them are probably better qualified to be governor of the state of Ohio than Jerry Springer, who really never run anything in terms of the government. When he was a mayor of Cincinnati, the mayor had absolutely no executive authority whatsoever. Was a symbolic position, just cut ribbons, issued proclamations and that sort of things. But these other people are some people with some serious political and government experience.
Now, Howard, Jerry Springer actually ran in the Democratic primary in 1982 for Ohio governor.
He did.
Yeah? Okay.
He came in third in a three-person primary. Dick Celeste and William J. Brown, who was attorney general at the time, and then Jerry Springer came in third.
Was that the only time he's made a foray into statewide politics?
That is the only time he has run in a statewide race.
And you got to consider
1982.
You got to consider back then all he was known for was being mayor of Cincinnati.
Yeah.
Now he's a
council member,
nationwide.
Yeah. Right.
Now he's a nationally known figure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Then you got outside of Cincinnati and nobody knew who Jerry Springer was. He was running around. I was working a little newspaper in Troy, Ohio at the time, and he just kind of walked into our office one day and said, "Hey, my name's Jerry Springer. Can I sit in and talk to you for a while?" And I said, "Yeah, sure."
Yeah.
But, you know, people didn't know him outside of Cincinnati.
Yeah, and listening to him, Howard, I wonder if you get the same impression listening to some of the themes that he touches on when he talks. He reminds me of Bernie Sanders a bit.
Yeah. Oh, he's got a good streak of old-fashioned populist that runs through his political rhetoric when you hear him speak about politics, when you hear him talk politics. He comes from that wing of the party.
Now, Joe, Cordray may not have the same charisma, but does he have a message that would resonate with voters, do you think, because he's been working with the government, taking on big corporations, looking out for the little guy? You think maybe that would work to his advantage?
Oh, sure. He has a message. And I think he's, he's got experience. He's served in many capacities in state and now federal government with this latest one. But he comes with a different set of chops here. He has different things in his corner. His experience is in his corner. He's also very measured, unlike Jerry Springer, who is more... how should I say this? He's more animated and more,
emotional,
gut reaction kind of person. If you listen to Richard Cordray, he's very well thought out. He doesn't really get angry, or he doesn't really get, you know, very animated with anything. He's smart. I mean, I think he's widely regarded by both Republicans and Democrats who have worked with him as being smart. You know, everyone knows he's a Jeopardy champion. I think he's a three-time Jeopardy
champion.
Wow. Yeah, something like that. He's way smarter than Joe Ingles, let's put it that way.
Yeah, or me. But, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, he's absolutely he has the resume to do this. One thing that he could run on as the head, you know, if his experience as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is say, "Hey, look, Ohio, I recovered $12 billion from unscrupulous payday lenders and banks and other people to people who had been cheated. That's an accomplishment. I did that myself. And that's not a bad thing to run on.
Yeah, but he does lack charisma, and he is a no-nonsense guy. And I think in order to get that message out there, he needs to be backed by a powerful political machine. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are questioning if the Ohio Democratic Party can be that powerful political machine. It hasn't been able to pull it out in the past. But again, on the other side, if he did jump into the race, he could tap into a lot of nationwide donors, the Senator Elizabeth Warren type of people who can fundraise for him, right, and get a lot of money to put into that machine.
So at this point, we have, what, Howard, four Democrats who have definitely announced that they're going to run for governor?
They're going to debate, hold the first of six debates next Tuesday in Martins Ferry, which is in eastern Ohio along the Ohio River. And that location was not picked by accident, because that's an area that went for Donald Trump in 2016. And I think the Ohio Democratic Party wants to roll out its current crop of candidates in that kind of an area and get them exposure in that part of the state. Now, the only question is, are they going to have to drag a fifth chair onto the stage between now and Tuesday? I don't know the answer.
Fifth,
to that.
Maybe sixth chair?
Or sixth chair, right.
Yeah, we just don't know at this point. What about on the Republican side? They've got same thing, four candidates at this point. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah, they've got four, and I think it's going to stay that way. You've got Mike DeWine, Attorney General, Secretary of State John Husted, Congressman Jim Renacci, and then Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor. So I think those four are going to be the four. If anything, I think one or two of them might drop out before the primary even gets started. Right. If you look at some of the fundraising that's been happening, DeWine and Husted have been raising a lot of money. Renacci put in a lot of his own money into his coffers. So I think money's going to play a big role leading up to the primary to see if we're actually going to have four, or if it might dwindle down to three or two.
Yeah, I agree. And then on the Democratic side, among those four, you could see possibly one or two of them end up as running mates for the other candidates who are stronger and doing better and raising money and name recognition and that sort of thing.
And remind me again, we got Nan Whaley who's running.
Nan Whaley, the mayor of Dayton, mm-hmm. Connie Pillage, former state representative who's from Montgomery. And we also have
Betty
Joe Schiavone. Betty Sutton, the former congresswoman. Mm-hmm. And Joe Schiavone, who up until recently was the Ohio Senate Minority Leader.
Andy, I wanted to ask you about this, too. You wrote about this, the U.S. Senate race between incumbent Sherrod Brown and challenger Josh Mandel. It's kind of rare to have the same two candidates going head-to-head two elections in a row, isn't it?
Yeah, and we've kind of seen this possible rematch between Mandel and Brown. The writing's been on the wall for a while between these two. Mandel has made it clear for a long time now that he's been wanting to run for the Senate again. The University of Virginia Center for Politics did a study of how many times this has actually happened, how many times the same two candidates for Senate have gone head-to-head in consecutive elections. It's only happened 46 times nationwide in the history of U.S. Senate races. So it's very rare. But of those times, Ohio has seen this happen once. It was between Howard Metzenbaum and Robert Taft Jr. And of those 46, only six times has that challenger come back from losing the first time and then winning the second time. And Metzenbaum is among those six who actually won the second time around. So if you're really trying to break down the numbers as precisely as possible, it has happened in Ohio. So Mandel statistically still has a chance here.
I'll do a shameless plug that on Sunday at,
I would expect nothing less, Howard.
WVXU.org, I'll have a column on that very subject. And I'm actually old enough to have covered both of those Ohio races, Metzenbaum and Taft, and now this coming Mandel-Brown race.
Andy, Joe, and Howard, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Andy Chow and Joe Ingles with Ohio Public Radio, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Coming up, we'll hear about an in-depth look at the impact of the local drug epidemic. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Dozens of Cincinnati Inquirer reporters and photographers have been taking an in-depth look at the local drug epidemic for a special report, Heroin's Impact on Cincinnati. Cincinnati Inquirer, Hamilton County reporter Dan Horn is here to tell us about it. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dan, thank you. Good to see you this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this project. This was pretty ambitious. You had how many people involved in this?
Yeah, we had upwards of 60 people, editors, reporters, photographers, videographers. And the idea was to just go out and canvas the community for a year, for a week, a full 7 days. And we did that from July 10th to July 16th. And the hope was to just kind of capture the depth and breadth of this problem and give people maybe a different perspective on a problem we've all been hearing a lot about over the last several years, unfortunately.
Yeah, so the idea was to put, what, more of a human face on this?
Right. I think, you know, Terry DeMio, who's been covering heroin for us for several years now at the Post, or at the Inquirer, and betraying my old job at the Post years ago, she's written extensively about heroin for some time. And I think, you know, what she was finding, what some of us who've also covered the heroin epidemic have found, is that some people are starting to become a little desensitized to this. We hear about it all the time. It's on TV all the time. It's on the radio all the time. And it's very easy to not see the people who are suffering through this all around you, whether they're the children of heroin addicts, whether they're the people addicted to heroin themselves, whether it's the first responders who have to deal with this every day, trying to bring these folks back when they overdose, whether it's hospitals, clinics, treatment centers, all these places that are overwhelmed by this epidemic. It's become pretty easy not to see the stuff that's all around you. And so I think the hope was that a 24/7 approach for a full week where we just go out and cover the heck out of it and just show people what this looks like, what normal looks like now,
yeah,
would be a way to maybe shake off some of that desensitization that people are having toward this.
That's kind of the sad thing about it. Now, you chose July 10th through the 16th. And there were, I think, by your count, there were so many deaths, 18 deaths, I believe,
right,
and 180 overdoses, and that has become normal. That's what's, I think, what is sad about the whole thing is that people just say, oh, that's typical. That's what's
right.
Happening.
Yeah. I think as we wrote in this story, you know, a typical week is no less terrible just because it's typical. And, you know, what we found by the end of this week, we had one coroner said this has been a crazy light week for overdoses. And
wow.
We confirmed about 180 overdoses, but that's low. That's only people who required hospitalization. So that number could be double that. It could be more. You know, we confirmed 18 fatalities due to overdoses. And that's normal now. You know, this is the kind of thing that happens every week. It's not exceptional. We didn't have an extraordinary event where carfentanil, this deadly synthetic opopiate, was getting into heroin and cocaine and stuff like that, and would kill large groups of people. We didn't have anything like that this week. It was just a normal, awful week in the heroin epidemic.
And that's what's sad. It's typical, but it's still awful.
Right.
Now, this is going to turn into a 20-page special section that
right.
comes out on Sunday.
Correct.
That to me seems exceptional. I mean, is that a normal thing for a newspaper to devote that many pages to something like this?
No, I can't think of another time we've devoted that much space to a single story since I've been at the Inquirer. It's been 18 years now. So, no, this is exceptional. And our editor, Peter Bhatia, our lead editor on this project, Amy Wilson, and all the folks involved in this have really made this a priority. They really made a commitment to highlight this work and to, get this message out there and get this story out there.
What were some of the experiences that you and the other reporters and photographers had as you were putting this together?
Well, I think it's interesting because a lot of us had, I think, developed some of that same feeling of this is a routine kind of thing that we think we were encountering elsewhere in the community. We're no different than anybody else. And I think by pushing us all out into the field again and going out to where all these folks are and seeing this happen before our eyes, it's just a reminder of just how ingrained in our community this thing has become and how big a problem it has become. And to see, you know, to, you know, spend an evening with a grandmother trying to raise her two grandchildren because her daughter died of an overdose, or with a mom who's taking her daughter, her baby daughter, in for a checkup, and we find 10 days after we talk to her, she dies of an overdose. Mm. You know, we spend time with folks in the jail, you know, that right when they're at their worst moments. And you see this over and over and over again, and you see resilience in some of these folks. You see resignation in some of them. But you get an appreciation for just how big a problem this is. And I think it was eye-opening to see the human face on it for a lot of reporters, including myself, who don't cover this day in and day out.
Yeah, how big a problem it is, how widespread, too. I mean, this is affecting the suburbs, the city, rural areas. It's not just happening in the city, is it?
Yeah, we weren't hanging out in Over the Rhine and the West End the whole time. We were in Westchester and Sharonville and Butler County, Warren County. Butler County actually led the way in overdoses in this particular week. You know, we had reporters working for other Gannett papers in Ohio, in Chillicothe and Newark, and they were involved in this as well. And so small towns, big cities, little towns in Kentucky, Cincinnati, it doesn't matter. This thing is everywhere.
Dan, as you're working on this personally, what hit you the most as you're doing this?
I think the kids, for me, I think was the hardest thing to see, because you see kids who've been orphaned by this, whose parents have overdosed and died because of it. You see kids who are in foster care because of this, and you know they're vaguely aware in some cases, and in some cases very aware of why they're there, because their parents can't stop doing this. And you know, you see, you know, just how tough some of them are, and you also get an appreciation for just how tough a road they've got to go because of heroin.
You get a sense of the impact this is having on families around our area?
Absolutely. You know, that, you know, we track, one of the stories we track, you know, most of these stories are relatively short, you know, moments in time that we capture as we go through the week. But there is one story in particular that we track every day. And it's two mothers, one of whose son died on the Monday we started this project, and the other who had a relapse and vanished on her. And so we spent a lot of time with them that particular week, and just getting an appreciation of what it's like to not know where your kid is, but to know nothing good is going on. And in another case, to have to spend a week figuring out how to bury your son. And, you know, those kind of stories are tough, and they're out there every single week, not just the week we were doing the story.
Yeah. The photographers were involved in this, too. Did they get a lot of video footage and pictures of
right, incidents? Yeah. Carrie Cochran and Meg Vogel and several other videographers have put together a 30-minute mini documentary that's going to be running with this story, and that will go up Sunday as well. And, you know, they're just polishing that off now. But many of the photographers and some of the reporters captured video while they were out. And a lot of that's going to show up.
Yeah. Well, what's the inquiry's policy as far as showing the faces of these folks?
Well, you know, if they've been arrested, something like that, or if we speak to them and they're in a public place, I think as long as you're in a park, where we're under bridges, we're on streets, you know, that kind of thing is, if it happens in a public place, then, you know, you're able to record that. And we had a lot of conversations about what to use and what not to use, and we're still having them. You know, just because you can use something doesn't mean you should, and so those conversations are going on. But you know, we also want to tell the story honestly, and it's not pretty. It's, you know, people are found at their worst in you know, when the paramedics show up for an overdose call, and we were there for some of that. But you know, that's unfortunately the face of this thing.
So. You looked also at the impact on first responders?
Well, we did ride-alongs with police and paramedics, and you get a sense from that, you know, of what, you know, how draining that is day after day to do this. I mean, we literally were there a few times where they would, you know, revive someone and say, you know, we need to take you to the hospital, and they just say no and wander off, and that's it. So five or six police officers and paramedics were surrounding this person and bringing them literally back to life, and a few minutes later, they're just walking back off into the into the city, and they may see them again.
That has to be very frustrating for them.
It is, yeah.
Were the first responders pretty open to talking to you about how they feel about responding to this time and time again?
I think, because this was happening in real time, we were actually seeing them do their work more than just interviewing them. But certainly they were open to sharing that with us. And I think they would like people to be aware of just how big a problem this is. It becomes routine for them, too, but they have to deal with it very personally every day. People are dying in front of them every day, and people are being revived and going back out and doing heroin, and they're reviving them again. This happens over and over again. And you see it at the jail especially, where, a huge percentage of the population over there has a heroin problem. They've estimated that at least 200 inmates on the week that we were tracking this had admitted to a heroin problem. And obviously that number is going to be a lot higher, because that's just the people who admit to it. They've estimated that number could be as many as half the people in the jail.
As you're reporting on this, Dan, did you get a sense? Are we turning a corner? Is there a light around? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel on this whole thing?
Well, you hope so. It doesn't appear to be waning in any way at this point. There does seem to be a growing awareness among government officials and treatment and hospital officials that, this is a problem that is not going to just go away, and we have to figure out how we can deal with it in a long-term way, and, what kind of treatments work and what kind of, medications will help people get off this, because it's not as simple as saying just stop doing it. And I think there's a growing awareness among the public and among the people who deal with this and have to spend money to try to fix the problem that, we've got to come up with some better ideas here, because folks aren't just going to stop. They're going to do this until they die in many cases.
So what do you see as far as the media's role? How can the media help in dealing with this? I guess it's just a matter of keeping it out in front of people and not letting it fall off the map.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, Terry DeMeo has been covering heroin for the Inquirer now for some time, I guess probably more than 2 years now. And, she's on this every day. She lives it. And I know other media outlets have also covered this pretty aggressively. And I think that's our job, it's not our job necessarily to come up with an answer to all this stuff, but I think we have to, report what's going on in our community, and this is a very big thing that's going on in our community. I don't think you'd find too many people who would argue this isn't the biggest health crisis that's going on in the city right now. If you had in 1 week 180 people shot and 18 people dead, people would be up in arms about it. But because it's heroin, it's just routine. And so I think part of our goal with this story was to put that back out there and make people aware of what's going on every week.
So were you surprised how much people shared with you as you were out interviewing folks and covering these things?
Yeah, I'm always surprised at how open a lot of people are. And I think in a case like this, people, maybe not surprisingly, people who've been through this are often very willing to talk about it. I think a lot of them feel an obligation to try to help people who are going through the things that they went through. And I certainly saw that. I know other reporters did too. Even if they're still in it, even they're still struggling, if they're in a program, some people would talk to us only on condition they not be fully identified. There's some of that. But for the most part, people were very open. Even people who are frankly, at their worst on the streets, were willing to at least talk to us and in many cases be photographed. I think, it's encouraging that many people are willing to talk about a problem that's this big.
Dan, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
You.
Cincinnati Inquirer, Hamilton County reporter Dan Horn. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elster was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. And this is Selena's last day with us as she moves on to other opportunities, and we'd like to thank her for all the great work she's done with Cincinnati Edition. Selena, we're going to miss you, and we wish you very well.